That's the cry of an orangutan, the red ape that lives in the steamy jungles of Borneo and Sumatra. Carl van Schaik is a Dutch anthropologist who's been studying orangutans for nearly 20 years, especially one group of Sumatran apes that shows clear signs of learning passed down from one generation to the next. This study may offer insights into our own cultural evolution. Van Schaik's written a book called Among Orangutans. He told Steve Paulson that red apes are full of surprises.
We're pretty sure that they live easily into their 50s and maybe into their 60s in the wild.
Wow, that's incredibly long.
Exactly. Well, I call them slow motion animals because everything is slow about them except their minds. So, for instance, it takes about 15 years for a female to start reproducing. And then the average interval between subsequent births of one female is 9 years.
Hmm.
So they're amazingly slow. And then they live this very long lives, and then they move around in the trees very slowly. Everything's slow about orangutans.
But that's astonishing that the females don't become sexually mature until they're 15 years old. I mean, that means they've got to stay around for a long time. They have to survive all those years before they can reproduce. I mean, from an evolutionary perspective, that's kind of mind-boggling.
That's exactly right. In other words, if you are such a slow developer and you give birth so slowly, then you have to live to a long, ripe old age in order to balance this. And it raises yet another question, right? Why do they live so long? And that's where the intelligence and the development of intelligence and the whole issue of culture comes in.
The whole issue of culture. You're saying orangutans have culture.
The first thing that struck us, the book is about a story of a rather unusual population where we found animals using a variety of tools. And everybody in the population was using these tools. And I had worked earlier and later again, too, at another site that's only about 70 kilometers away, where nothing of that sort ever happened. And so the question is, well, why do we see that here and not somewhere else? So why does this amazing geographic variation?
What kinds of tools were they using?
You know, you have a tree with a little hole in it, and it's, say somewhere up 10 meters up or something. And those little tree holes often contain nests of termites or ants, or most interestingly for an orangutan, stingless bees. So tiny little bees that don't sting but have little nests in tree holes that contain honey. And so how do you get in there? Because it's wooded. Your finger goes only so far if it gets in there at all. And so in some places, animals have figured out that if you break off a stick and sort of make it right, then you can insert it into that tree hole. And if you do the right manipulation inside that tree hole, you actually get the honey out, and you lick it off and you stick it in again, and so on and so forth. Those tree holes are found everywhere, of course. There's stingless bees living in lots of those tree holes, but there's only a few places, I actually know of only one, where they then use the tools to extract them. And so it really opens up sort of a new niche for these animals. The second major form of tool use, which is for us easier to map, is there's a big fruit. It's a woody fruit, and it sort of opens, it splits, and then it displays nice rows of sort of lima-sized seeds, brown seeds, that are inside almost 50% fat, so really good to eat. However, they're embedded in a matrix of razor-sharp hairs, so if you or I stick our finger in there to pick one of those seeds or to sort of extract those seeds, then we're going to be attacked by those hairs, and they pierce the skin, and it's really painful. So what do you do? Well, orangutans have figured out that as soon as that fruit splits open and the seeds are sort of visible, you can scoop out those seeds with a tool and drop the seeds in your mouth and don't have to worry about those hairs. And so what we found is that everybody in the population does those different kinds of tool use. And you move somewhere else, and then nobody does it.
So they all learn from each other.
Exactly. So the conclusion was, it's not the forest, it's not the fruit that's different, it's the animals that are different. They must have learned it from each other. Somebody invented it, and then it was maintained because they learned it from each other.
Well, this raises fascinating questions about human evolution. And,
exactly.
I mean, where, at what point did our ancestors start to diverge to become something that resembles the humans that we know today?
Right. And so because orangutans and chimpanzees were actually extremely similar in their cultural basis, that suggests to me that the first hominids, the first upward walking apes that became our, us, that they came equipped with this basic set of cultural skills. And so they were sort of like chimpanzees and orangutans in their capabilities.
Are we talking, 5 million years ago or so?
Yeah, 5, 6, 7, the jury's still out exactly on how long ago that is. And then for many million years, not much happened. And that changed at around 2 million, where you suddenly see these hominids that have a body built much more like us, that are clearly going out in the open, and suddenly you see tools that are a little bit more sophisticated that are clearly outside the range, the cognitive range of great apes.
It also raises an interesting question about why the most intelligent great apes, orangutans and chimpanzees, have not become more like humans. Why haven't they developed along the evolutionary path that humans did?
Right. And so that's the big question. Why did they stay where they were, pretty much? So why did this one lineage diverge in a really dramatic fashion? And I suspect at the moment, right now it's just speculation, because if you look at the cultural process, what sort of drives it? One of the things that's really important is how many experts are around you, how many animals are near you that know something you don't as you grow up. Term social tolerance or sociability there is key. Basically, the more tutors there are, the more time you can spend in school, the fancier your cultural repertoire is going to be. And that could sort of trigger a snowball-like process.
And so you're saying that there's only so much of that among the great apes.
I'm saying that basically their ecology sort of keeps them back, because with this exception of this unusual population that I found, orangutans are really remarkably solitary. So they learn a lot from their mothers, and they learn a little bit from others around them, but the repertoire that you can maintain in a population is limited that way. And so if you create conditions, such as sort of what we do in zoos, you see a different orangutan from what you see in most wild places, because suddenly they can flourish.
And you're saying in zoos or in research labs, they show all kinds of skills. I mean, for one thing, there are those language tests that orangutans and chimpanzees have been able to master. I mean, fairly sophisticated manipulation of linguistic symbols.
Right. And so what that suggests is that you might say they're latent capabilities. I say somewhere they seem to be overqualified for their jobs in the forest. And so what is created is this sort of blank slate that, depending on how rich the inputs are, can create an organism anywhere from a country bumpkin to a genius. And so the forest provides only that much inputs. You hit a ceiling there, because ecologically they cannot live in larger units and be friendly and nice to each other without running into major competition. The site I worked at, that ceiling was much higher because the ecology was such that they could spend a lot of time together, and as soon as they can, they do. And so what I'm suggesting is that during human evolution, something happened that made that systematic, and then you sort of get into some synergistic feedback loop that you reach escape velocity, so to speak.
There would be a fascinating scientific experiment that probably would be unethical, but to take one or two of those zoo orangutans who've learned all kinds of stuff from humans and reintroduce them back into this group in the wild in Sumatra.
Well, you know what would happen? They would be considered idiots, because they wouldn't even know how to climb trees decently. And we have some evidence that animals that were introduced into the forest and had taken with them a few rather irrelevant skills, for instance, eating cardboard out of trash cans, or trying to look for clothes on a clothesline and sort of draping themselves into it, that those habits have gone several generations down the line now. So there's a grandchild of one of the original released animals still doing it. But none of the wild ones, even though they have opportunities to observe this, have ever thought it was necessary to copy such a silly behavior.
But it also raises questions about what we mean by intelligence, in particular for wild animals. I mean, there's no reason why they should care about linguistic symbols or clothing or anything like that. It's not going to help them out there, at least not for millions of years down the evolutionary road.
Right.
And so, maybe it's unfair to say, well, orangutans or chimpanzees just aren't that smart because they don't do all the stuff that humans do, but why should they?
Exactly. Why should they? But culture is an essential component of intelligence. You might even say culture arises as a byproduct of intelligence because, like I say, you start out as a blank slate, and humans are more of a blank slate than, say, opossums. Now, you can create your own inputs by exploration and so on, but it's a lot easier to look at animals that were your elders, so to speak, that were clearly successful in this habitat and just copy what they're doing. So you can reach much higher levels of intelligence by social learning. So it turns out that intelligence is not this sort of solitary genius, you know, tinkering around somewhere in a dark corner. No, it is the social animals that turn out to be the intelligent ones.
And I suppose the other piece of this for orangutans is they would seem to have a certain capacity to learn these things, partly because they're so slow to mature. I mean, they're hanging out with their mothers for the first 15 years, and I presume the reason that they do that is they're learning all kinds of things. For some reason, that equips them to be more successful later on in life.
That's exactly right. So if you follow a mother-infant pair around, the youngster tends to copy what the mother is doing. They go into a tree, the mother eats, youngster eats. And then it's sort of, I call it guided exploration. It's very sort of conservative almost in its exploration. And it learns an immense amount of its mother. And then sort of by the time it's weaned, which is after, say, in Sumatra, 7-8 years, it sort of broadens its horizon a little bit. And it meets other animals now in a more independent way, so it can follow them around a bit. And what you see is it follows these animals very closely around. And when they're doing something interesting, like, say, some kind of foraging technique, they come closer and closer. You see them inching closer, literally to a few inches from their faces to see exactly what they're doing. They're just sort of gobbling up all this information to equip them for life. And, of course, the rule then is, the richer your input, the richer your intellectual performance as an adult. And that is the process, I think, we're seeing magnified in humans. But the process itself is a lot older and a lot more general, and probably also applies to some birds and some other mammals, you know, elephants and dolphins and so on.
Fascinating. Thank you so much for talking about all of this.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Carl van Schaik, talking with Steve Paulson. Van Schaik is an anthropologist at the University of Zurich in Switzerland. His book is called Among Orangutans.